Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. And I'd like to welcome our online and radio audiences as well as our audience here in San Francisco. Tonight's lecture is going to be given by Seth Rosenfeld, the author of Subversives. And it's just a great book. I recommend it very highly. It's a great look at the behind the scenes, what was going on during the 60s in Berkeley. And I can tell from the audience that a few of you are around for that. I'm not sure that many of you remember it, and even if you did remember it, depending on how active you were, how much of this detail would you have known? I mean, we were all suspicious of what was going on, but Seth sort of filled in the details of why we were suspicious. There was a good reason. Seth Rosenfeld. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure to be here speaking with you tonight about my book, Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. Subversives is a history of the FBI's secret activities at the University of California during the Cold War, and more particularly, a history of the FBI's unlawful surveillance and harassment of students and professors and even administrators and members of the UC Board of Regents during the 60s. The book is based on four main characters: J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, Clark Kerr, the president of the University of California, Mario Savio, who was the leader of the 1964 free speech movement, and Ronald Reagan, who was a neophyte politician running for his first elected office as governor of California in 1966. Each of these people had a profound impact on the nation. Each, in their own way, was brilliant. And each had a deep involvement with the FBI. And by tracing the FBI's relationship with each of them, what I have hoped to do in the book is to provide a fresh look at the 60s and to reveal a secret history and how that affected not only Berkeley and the University of California, but the nation. I first became interested in this subject in 1981 when I was a student at UC Berkeley. I was studying journalism and writing for the Daily Californian student newspaper. One day, my editor at the Daily Cal called me up and said that the paper had gotten a bunch of FBI files under the Freedom of Information Act, and he asked me if I would be interested in taking a look at them. Well, I jumped at the chance. I knew, of course, that Berkeley had been the scene of some of the biggest protests of the 60s. And I knew also that during the 70s, congressional hearings, particularly those led by Senator Frank Church, had exposed widespread FBI and CIA domestic surveillance in violation of the law. So I was very curious to know what had the FBI been up to at Berkeley. Soon I was pushing a hand truck full of FBI records across the campus to my apartment on University Avenue. I burrowed into those records, and even before I had finished writing my first stories about them, I realized there was much more to find out. I could see that the FBI was withholding huge amounts of records, and I could see that there were many other records that hadn't even been requested. So I typed up an expanded Freedom of Information Act request on my old Royal typewriter and took an onion skin copy down to the main Berkeley post office and mailed it off. I figured I'd get the records in about a year and I'd write it up and go on to my next project. I had no idea I was embarking on what would become a 27-year legal odyssey in which I would bring five lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act that would all go all the way up to the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court, that five federal judges would order the FBI ultimately to release more than 300,000 pages of records concerning the University of California, and that the courts would also order the FBI to pay my attorney's fees of more than $1 million. In fact, just in October, one of the judges ordered the FBI to pay $470,000 to the First Amendment Project of Oakland, which had been carrying my case pro bono for the last 15 years or so. Well, all these records were released over a period of years, and they began to fill up my apartment with boxes and more boxes, and I began to read through them. I took some time off from work. I was a reporter at the San Francisco Examiner and then the San Francisco Chronicle, and I studied these documents. And I could see there was a big story there, but I couldn't quite get my hands around it. So before my leave was finished, I had to go back to work. But then in 2009, I left the Chronicle to focus on this book, which was published in August by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And the book begins in the years during and right after World War II. And at this time, the FBI had a massive investigation focusing on Soviet attempts to steal nuclear secrets from the nuclear laboratories run by UC Berkeley. The FBI had a wiretap on the local Communist Party office and had overheard a discussion between Soviet officials at the Soviet consulate in San Francisco and Communist Party officials scheming to approach Robert Oppenheimer, the chief scientist in the nuclear project, and to try and get secrets from him. So Hoover launched this massive investigation codenamed CINRAD, Communist Infiltration of the Radiation Laboratory. And this went on for several years, and ultimately several people were arrested in the case. But what the FBI records show is that in the years right after that, the Bureau diverged from this important national security mission of protecting the nation from espionage to focus instead on students and professors engaged in lawful dissent. In the early 1950s, the FBI had a secret operation codenamed the Responsibilities Program. And under this program, FBI officials in every state secretly gave their respective governors allegations that certain professors were somehow involved in un-American activity. The governors would take this information and pass it to the president of the university. The president of the university would then investigate it, and they would confront the professor about this. Now, there was no due process. The professor never knew the source of these allegations. The professor never had the opportunity to cross-examine them. But nonetheless, FBI records show that nearly 1,000 professors across the country were ultimately forced from their jobs as a result of this program, which Hoover ended only after he became worried that news about it would leak out and it would be a huge scandal for the FBI. Well, Hoover's concern about the University of California grew in the following years as students began to become more involved in protest. They were breaking with the campus complacency of the 1950s and becoming more engaged in issues beyond the edge of the campus, such as the death penalty issue, nuclear disarmament, and particularly civil rights. In 1959, there was a question that particularly concerned J. Edgar Hoover, a question that appeared on the English entrance examination for high school students coming to UC Berkeley. The question was an optional essay question, and it asked, what are the dangers to a democracy of a national police organization like the FBI, which operates secretly and is unresponsive to public criticism? Well, when news of this question reached J. Edgar Hoover, he was livid, and he ordered his agents to mount what was essentially a covert public relations campaign. The first part of it was aimed at making the university retract the question. And the FBI did this by contacting its allies at various news organizations or political organizations, church organizations, and getting them to write letters to the Board of Regents complaining about this question. And it did work, and the Regents did retract this question. Hoover, however, was not satisfied. He next ordered his agents to identify the author of the question. And after an extensive investigation, they settled on a professor at UCLA. At that point, the FBI records show that agents prepared an anonymous letter accusing this professor of being a dangerous communist and sending it to the chancellor at UCLA. Well, the chancellor received this letter. He questioned the professor, but he didn't take any action. He just wasn't convinced there was enough evidence. And it's a good thing that he didn't take any action because, in fact, the FBI had the wrong man. This professor had not written the question. Hoover then ordered his agents to investigate the entire university. He wanted to know what was the political complexion of the University of California. And as a result of this, the FBI produced an 80-page report that listed professors and students who were allegedly engaged in subversive activity. They included 72 people who were on something called the Security Index. This was a secret list, not even Congress or the Department of Justice knew about it, of people who were to be detained without a warrant in the event of a national emergency and held indefinitely. And in the Bay Area, I was told by one former FBI agent, they were to be held at a facility on Angel Island. So Hoover was concerned about the University of California, and his concern grew in 1961 when students invited somebody named Frank Wilkinson to come and talk on campus. Wilkinson was a housing official from Los Angeles County, and he had been accused of being a communist and hauled before the House Un-American Activities Committee. He refused to testify there, and it was found in contempt. He then appealed, and it was at this point that the students wanted him to come and talk on campus. Well, the campus had recently adopted a policy which allowed speakers of all kinds to come and talk. But the policy required them to try and balance the speaker. So Clark Kerr, the president of the university, had a letter written to J. Edgar Hoover inviting him to send somebody to speak to balance the views expressed by Frank Wilkinson. Well, this only incensed Hoover even more. There's one FBI memo that was released to me about this incident, and in it, Hoover writes in the margins in his trademark jagged scrawl, "I am absolutely opposed to this crowd of bleeding hearts at Berkeley using the FBI to get off the hook. I know Kerr is no good, and I doubt Cragen is." Cragen was the vice chancellor at the time. So here was the head of the nation's largest law enforcement organization calling the president of the nation's largest and leading public university no good. And when the free speech movement erupted in 1964, Hoover's view of the university only grew dimmer. That summer, many students from Berkeley had gone to Mississippi to participate in the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project, in which they helped register blacks to vote. One of those people was Mario Savio. Savio was a philosophy student at Berkeley. He was from New York. At this point in his life, he would have been in his early 20s. He had a genius-level IQ, and he had been raised in a devoutly Catholic family. In fact, he thought he would grow up to be a priest. He would be known as Father Bob. But as he went through high school and he studied philosophy and science, he began to doubt the dogma, and he, by and by, fell away from his faith. But he internalized the message to do good in the world. And in Savio's view, the most important thing happening in the United States at that time was the civil rights movement. So he committed himself to that. He went to the South, and he returned that fall of 1964 to Berkeley, only to discover that the University of California was still enforcing a rule that prohibited students from engaging in off-campus political activity. This meant that they couldn't hand out a flyer for civil rights or collect quarters. They couldn't even hand out flyers for Barry Goldwater, who who was nominated that summer at the Republican National Convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Well, Savio and the other students were outraged about this. They not only felt that this was a denial of their constitutional rights, but that they had a moral commitment to work for civil rights. So they tried to negotiate with the university, but these negotiations failed. And then that fall, one morning, they set up a card table on Sproul Plaza, in front of the main administration building, and defiantly began to hand out flyers. Well, no sooner had they started to do this than a campus police car rolled up, and several officers arrested a man behind the table named Jack Weinberg, who had just graduated with honors in mathematics, and they loaded him into the back of the car. But before they could drive away, the students began to sit down around the police car, and soon Sproul Plaza was filled with students sitting down surrounding the police car, and they held it captive for the next 33 hours. And this was the beginning of the free speech movement, and it was shocking to many Californians who were much more accustomed to the campus complacency of the 1950s. When reports about this protest reached Hoover's desk, he ordered his agents to intensify their investigation on campus and to determine whether the free speech movement was part of a subversive plot. And there's a series of documents that were released to me as a result of my lawsuits, in which the San Francisco FBI reports back, well, we've investigated this, and it's true there are one or two communists or socialists who are involved among the hundreds of students in the free speech movement, but they really had no bearing on this protest. It was really just a protest against a campus rule. Well, Hoover wasn't satisfied. He ordered them to investigate again. They sent back another memo saying the same thing. He still wasn't happy. He ordered them to investigate further. Finally, a third memo goes back in January of 1965. And in my lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act, the court concluded that it was as of this point that the FBI's investigation of the free speech movement ceased to have a legitimate law enforcement purpose. The court said, well, there was a little evidence that the FBI had to base a legitimate investigation on initially. But at this point, the Bureau had investigated and knew that this was not a subversive plot against the United States. So the surveillance that continued after that, including efforts to surveil and harass Mario Savio, to disrupt and neutralize him under the FBI's counterintelligence program, all of that was, according to the court, unlawful. Well, the students eventually won their protest. The regents acknowledged that December of 1964 that this rule was a violation of constitutional rights. And now students pretty much everywhere take for granted the right to engage in First Amendment activities on campus. But leaving aside the correctness of the students' position, J. Edgar Hoover was angrier than ever, and he blamed Clark Kerr, the president of the University of California. He blamed Kerr for not cracking down on the students. Also, in my Freedom of Information Act case, the court made a finding that the documents released concerning Clark Kerr showed that the FBI had waged a concerted effort to get him fired because FBI officials disagreed with his politics and with his campus policies. And these documents show that the FBI leaked information to members of the Board of Regents who it considered its allies, allegations about students and professors, with the goal that these regents could use that information to convince the board to fire Clark Kerr. Well, this went on throughout the summer of 1965. Dozens of memos were provided to this contact on the Board of Regents, whose name was Edwin Pauley. He was a Los Angeles oil man and strong supporter of the university, a contributor to the university, who was very outraged about these protests. But it came to no avail. they couldn't get the votes to fire Clark Kerr. And finally, according to one memo, the Bureau realized that as long as Pat Brown remained as governor and an ex officio member of the Board of Regents, that Clark Kerr would remain as president of the University of California because Brown was a staunch supporter of Kerr. Well, right about this time, Ronald Reagan is starting to run for governor of California. The FBI viewed Reagan's bid for the governor as a breath of fresh air. And one of the main reasons was that the Bureau had a covert relationship with Reagan that went back at least to 1946 in Hollywood. The FBI records show that the Bureau had a very involved relationship with Reagan. And I thought that this was among the most significant findings in my research because previous biographers of Reagan had been stymied because the FBI had released only 100 or 200 pages of FBI records on him. And these records were heavily redacted. So the FBI had effectively obscured its relationship with Reagan. These books I'm talking about, for example, Gary Wills' Reagan's America, or Ann Edwards' Early Reagan, Lou Cannon's book on Reagan. Well, we had a big fight in court over getting these Reagan records, and I had to bring a fourth lawsuit to get them. And by, the courts ordered the FBI to release approximately 10,000 pages on Reagan. And these documents provide the most complete account to date of the FBI's secret relationship with Reagan. Reagan himself hints at this relationship in his memoir entitled Where's the Rest of Me, which he published in 1965. He notes that one night in 1946, there was a knock on his door in Hollywood, and there were two FBI agents there, and they asked if they could come talk to him. So he said, come on in. And they told him that communists were infiltrating some liberal groups that he was involved in. Reagan, at this point in his life, was still a Democrat. He was involved in a number of liberal groups in Hollywood. As Reagan writes in his memoir, I must admit, they opened my eyes to a good many things. He doesn't say anything else about it. But what we know from these documents is that in the months and years following that, Reagan became a very active FBI informer. He named fellow actors and actresses, sometimes on the scantiest of evidence. And while he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, the FBI had wide access to records on guild members. In return for this, and I should say that this is exactly opposite to Reagan's public statement that he never pointed a finger at anyone. Well, in return for Reagan's help in Hollywood, J. Edgar Hoover did a number of personal and political favors for Reagan. One of them involved his daughter, Maureen Reagan. In 1960, Maureen Reagan, then 19 years old, had moved from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. She had taken a job as a secretary, and Reagan and his by now former wife, Jane Wyman, had heard that she was living with an older married policeman, and they were concerned about this. Now, many parents might have simply picked up the phone and called their daughter, but the Reagans turned to the FBI. And there's a series of memos that go all the way up to J. Edgar Hoover, who, even while noting that this is beyond the FBI's jurisdiction, authorizes an investigation. So one FBI agent posed as an insurance agent and questioned her neighbors. Another agent interviewed the maid at her rooming house, and a third agent spoke with local police. And they confirmed that she was living with an older married police officer, and they reported this back to the Reagans on the condition that they keep it secret and never reveal the FBI's involvement. Now, it's unclear how this information helped their relationship with their daughter. She writes many years later in her memoir that she never discussed this relationship with her family for a long time after. The FBI helped Reagan with another one of his wayward children several years later in 1965, this time Michael Reagan. At this moment, the FBI had a massive and highly publicized investigation into the organized crime operations of Joe Bonanno. Bonanno was perhaps the top mafia leader in the United States at that time, and he was living in Phoenix, from which he commanded his far-flung criminal enterprises. FBI agents doing surveillance there made an unexpected discovery. The son of Joe Bonanno, Joe Jr., was hanging out with the son of Ronald Reagan, Michael Reagan. The agents wanted to interview Ronald Reagan to see if he had heard anything from his son that might be useful to their investigation, which, after all, was a top priority. There was a grand jury investigation in New York about the Bonannos, and there were stories almost every other day in the New York Times about it. But Hoover interceded. He blocked the agents from questioning Ronald Reagan and instead ordered them to warn him about his son's unsavory relationship with the son of the mobster. And one of the most interesting documents that was released to me is an agent's summary of Reagan's reaction when he received this warning. And according to this document, Reagan says he's very grateful for this information, that he realizes that if the information leaked out, it would be damaging to any political aspirations that he might have. And further, that he realizes that it would be improper to express his appreciation to Hoover in writing. I later interviewed one of the officials who worked on Pat Brown's campaigns during that time period, and he told me that had the campaign known about Michael Reagan's relationship with Joe Jr., that they surely would have made an issue about it, perhaps questioning Reagan's role as a father and the guidance he had given his children. But as it turned out, that information never came out, and Reagan went on to win by a landslide in November of 1966. He won by more than a million votes. One of the main issues during his campaign was the mess at Berkeley, as it was called in those days. Reagan had vowed to clean up the protests, to crack down on the student protesters, and he used those protests as a way to attack Pat Brown, and he was rather ruthless about this. An example of that was in a speech that he gave at the Cow Palace again in May of 1966 in the heat of the campaign. And he said the following: "There is a leadership gap and a morality and decency gap in Sacramento, and there is no better illustration of that than what has been perpetrated at the University of California at Berkeley, where a small minority of beatniks, radicals, and filthy speech advocates have brought such shame to a great university." And this is really just an example of the kinds of statements he made throughout the campaign. Well, his message resonated. Many Californians were indeed shocked by the free speech movement and then by the anti-war protests, which came fast on its heels. So Reagan was elected, and within days of taking office, he phoned the FBI, and he asked for a secret briefing about the protests at Berkeley, and not only about the protesters, but about Clark Kerr, the president of the university, and members of the Board of Regents. Hoover granted this request. Two FBI agents drove from San Francisco to Sacramento, where they were led up the stairs of the governor's mansion and were somewhat surprised to find themselves in the governor's bedroom, where he was propped up in his four-poster bed with a bad case of the flu. Well, Reagan was so interested in knowing what the FBI had on Berkeley that he had this meeting anyway. So the agents gave him a briefing, and several weeks later, at the first regents meeting attended by Reagan, Clark Kerr was fired as president of the University of California. Reagan's appointment, I should say Reagan's election as governor had given him the opportunity to make several new appointments to the Board of Regents, and this shifted the balance of power. One of the FBI records indicates it's an interview with one of the regents who says that it was his understanding that Reagan had received certain information from the FBI and had discussed it prior to the firing of Clark Kerr. Well, the firing of Clark Kerr did not stop the protests at Berkeley. And as Reagan's governorship continued, he had further meetings with the FBI, which supplied him with secret reports about students and faculty members. And years later, when Reagan became president, it was his turn to return the favor to the FBI. He pardoned two agents who had been criminally convicted of illegal break-ins during the investigation of the Weather Underground in the 1970s. He also expanded FBI powers, and he imposed restrictions on the Freedom of Information Act. So I think ultimately what my book Subversives is about is it shows how tactics originally developed for use against foreign adversaries can be turned against citizens engaged in lawful dissent. Now, it's true the FBI is a very different organization today than it was then, and the director, Robert Mueller, is a very different person than J. Edgar Hoover. The FBI is much more accountable. There's much more oversight. But nonetheless, the FBI and other intelligence agencies depend on having a combination of great power and great secrecy to do their jobs. And that combination of power and secrecy is inherently dangerous to democracy. So ultimately, Subversives is a cautionary tale about the dangers of unchecked power and secrecy to a democracy. So I'd be happy to take any questions you might have. Thank you.
It's just to remind the online and radio audiences that they're listening to Seth Rosenfeld, the author of Subversives, speaking at the Commonwealth Club of California here in San Francisco. So it's time for questions and answers. Who would like to ask the first one?
Thank you very much. I'm curious about your investigation. When you got the first batch of FOIA documents, what were the clues that there was this whole slew of other things that you were going to have to bring suit? Were there ridiculous redactions or pages missing, or what led you to think there was all this other wealth of information?
Well, I could see by reading the files that so much had been blacked out, and I knew from some of my other research that that information really should have been released. I could tell that some of it had even been in newspaper accounts or congressional hearings or in books. By happenstance, had found a book, a used book, in a shop on Telegraph Avenue called I Lived Inside the Campus Revolution. And it was a tell-all book by a former student who had been a FBI informant. So comparing some of those pages to the documents I had, I could see that there was a connection there. And then there were references to other files that hadn't even been released. And I have to say I was very fortunate to have the support of a number of attorneys who took my cases pro bono over the years, the law office of Thomas Steele, the late Thomas Steele in San Francisco, and the attorneys who worked with him, and then subsequently the First Amendment Project of Oakland took my case, and Ben Stein, an attorney in Oakland, has also brought the fifth lawsuit. And without their help, I just don't think I would have ever received these files.
Oh, hi. I was there, 64 and 65, and it's interesting that it's kind of ironic that the enemy of the FSM was Clark Kerr. And, of course, you know, we didn't know anything about the FBI then, but that was the whole thing. Clark Kerr's idea of the multiversity as being this sort of corporate diet, which was that and the Board of Regents. You remember the famous chart of the corporate connections of the Board of Regents and so on, that it was seen by those of us who were there as just the other way around. And of course, that would have added another dimension that might have, tended to sort of balance that. But does your book go into that, by chance?
It does. It describes Kerr as being the man in the middle, the man with the students on the one side and Ronald Reagan and on the other side, and then behind the scenes, unbeknownst to Kerr or the students, certainly, the FBI working against him. Kerr was quite shocked when I sat down with him and showed him some of the documents that had been released. He had actually tried to get his FBI files years earlier. The FBI had dissuaded him from doing that, sort of saying that it would be just too involved and there wasn't much there. But he gave me permission to get his files, and ultimately we got some 1,500 pages, including the document that said, in which J. Edgar Hoover said, "I know Kerr is no good." And it was on the basis of those documents that the court concluded that the FBI had waged an unlawful campaign to get Kerr fired.
Yes, it's something I've always wondered. Under the Freedom of Information Act, can information still be hidden? And if so, how?
Yes. Well, the Freedom of Information Act, which is the main federal law giving citizens access to government records, says essentially that all executive branch records of the federal government are public unless they fall under 9 narrow categories. Well, it turns out those categories aren't so narrow. One of them is national security. Another one is law enforcement. Another one is personal privacy. So the FBI can legitimately withhold information if it falls under those categories. But what I've discovered over the years through my use of the Freedom of Information Act is that the FBI makes grossly exaggerated claims of secrecy and privacy. And unfortunately, that has continued even under the Obama administration.
Hi. I'd like to ask a question on a broader point of history that kind of relates to your book. I'm obviously English, so I don't know all of the ins and outs of American history, but there's something that's really fascinated me that has been brought up tonight, is that I wonder why, as it was obvious that kind of J. Edgar Hoover was such a paranoid wingnut, as you probably quantify him over here, how he was able to carry on this reign of terror for such a long time, apparently unchecked. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Right. Well, I describe in Subversives the origins of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover's tenure. And we don't really perhaps remember it, but Hoover was a folk hero for most of his tenure. He was very effective in fighting gangsters during the 30s, and he arrested saboteurs during World War II, and most Americans looked up to him as a hero. It wasn't until really the late 60s that more critical things started to come out, and then the mid-70s when congressional hearings really blew off the lid of improper FBI activities.
Just as an aside to that remark, if you read the history of the British activities against the German spies, whenever Hoover caught somebody, he made a big public announcement. Whenever the British caught somebody, they said nothing and turned them. And by the end of the war, almost the entire German spy network in England was working for England and not for Germany. But my question is, you talk in your punchline, unchecked power and secrecy. We're sitting today under something called the Patriots Act, which Clark Kerr's activities couldn't hold a candle in my book. What's your take on that?
Well, since 9/11, the FBI and other intelligence agencies have been given greatly expanded powers to conduct a very important national security mission. There's much more secrecy, and there's much more power as a result of that, and inherently much more of a potential risk to democracy just by the bureaucratic nature of it, even with the best of intentions. An example of that fairly recently was a report by the Justice Department's Inspector General, which found that the FBI had misused an administrative process known as a national security letter, which is kind of an administrative subpoena, where without a warrant they could go to a utility or a phone company or a bank and get a lot of detailed personal information about citizens. So that potential for abuse is there.
Now, you cite all these documents and records. Who did you interview for this particular book to corroborate or reject some of these suspicions and allegations?
Yes, thank you for that. The book is based primarily on the FBI records, but also on much more extensive research in many other archives, presidential depositories, the Reagan Library, the Bancroft Library at UC Berkeley, the Hoover Institution, newspaper archives. And then beyond that, I conducted more than 200 interviews with participants and observers on all sides. So former student activists, former administrators such as Clark Kerr, activists like Mario Savio, Reagan administration officials. I unfortunately didn't have a chance to interview Ronald Reagan, but I interviewed Edwin Meese, who was his top legal advisor for all these years. Former FBI agents spoke with me and sometimes were very revealing about things. And the process I used with the former FBI agents was to meet with them and to go over FBI records. And I spent many hours, long sessions doing this. And that helped me get an understanding of the special bureaucratic jargon of the documents. And it also helped them to recall events more clearly. One funny anecdote that came out of that concerned the FBI's investigation in Berkeley in the 50s of Jessica Mitford, the famous writer and muckraker. And she was involved in civil rights movement and early on had been a member of the Communist Party. So two FBI agents were assigned to conduct a surveillance of Mitford and a meeting she was having at her house. So one night they crawled into her basement in Oakland and set up a listening station there. But I guess they found the meeting kind of boring because one of them soon fell asleep and started to snore very loudly, which caused the other agent to become quite panicked. And he rousted his fellow agent, and they ran off into the night without getting caught.
Is the Commonwealth Club turning over our names to a to the FBI or other political? Were there any comments regarding the student organizations SLATE and SAT, and whether the FBI was involved in either of those organizations?
Yes. Well, in regards to SLATE, the answer is yes. The FBI had extensive files on SLATE. SLATE, which was an acronym which actually had no meaning, it just meant slate of students who are running for student government, was actually a precursor to the free speech movement in the late 50s and early 60s. And they had challenged some of the campus policies and were involved in different protests for civil rights, and the FBI had a file on them. And one of the interesting things in that file was the revelation that a vice chancellor named Alex Sheriffs, who has since passed away, he was the vice chancellor in charge of student affairs. And he was chosen for that job because he was very popular in the 50s with members of sororities and fraternities who dominated campus life. But as things shifted and Slate started to appear, he had a much more contentious relationship. And he became concerned to the point that one day he phoned the FBI and requested two agents to come meet with him at his office, in which he told them all about Slate's activities and his fears that they were part of a communist plot. So,
anything about SAT? Seems aligned against totalitarian. Was there, was the
Yes. There's also a file on that organization, which was a very conservative organization, and was involved in the publication of something called Toxin. Toxin was, you couldn't find it at a newsstand. It was a slick newsletter filled with photographs of people involved in protests on campus that were secretly taken by correspondents for Toxin. Toxin, according to the FBI records, was the regular recipient of FBI leaks of information, allegations that different students were somehow subversive or the children of people who had been communists, and similar reports from other law enforcement agencies. So the FBI used Toxin as a way to try and discredit and disrupt student activists at the University of California, Berkeley.
Any funding?
Yes. Toxin was funded by somebody named Patrick Frawley, who was the owner or one of the main owners of the Schick Razor Company. And that information came out in a court case because eventually Toxin was sued for libel by a San Francisco lawyer named Vincent Hallinan, who is also famous for once suing the church to prove the existence of God.
Do any Reagan advocates discredit you or your book currently?
Yeah, the book has been, I'm pleased to say, and I'm very grateful that it has been very well received overall. There have been some complaints from a small group of people on the left and a small group of people on the right. There was an article in Commentary magazine taking me to task for revealing that Reagan had been an informant in Hollywood. And then I also revealed in the book that a man named Richard Aoki, who was revered as a radical in Berkeley and had passed away several years ago, actually in 2007, that he had secretly been a paid FBI informant for 16 years. Mm-hmm. And that also sparked some criticism of me. Some questions were raised about whether I had sufficient evidence for it, and I maintained that I did. And then I'm very glad to say that, coincidentally, the courts ordered the release of additional FBI records concerning Richard Aoki, which further confirmed that he was a paid FBI informant.
So. My turn. I was a student on campus from September 59 till June 64. So saw the whole run-up to the free speech movement. And I have a question at the end of this, but I wanted to note that I was on a track to get a teaching credential, and we would hear speakers without a microphone at Wheeler Oak, including Ken Cloak, Mike Tiger, people reputed to be either communists or socialists. And we were told, as potential credential holders, do not get yourself photographed in this crowd. Because you never know if it could come back to bite you. This was on the heels of the House Un-American Activities and the Loyalty Oath. So there was a level of paranoia just free-floating. Question I have is, I've seen a picture at the Greek Theater of Mario Savio being hauled off the stage at an event. Apparently Clark Kerr had attempted to line up a matching speaker, and the Berkeley police or the Alameda sheriff, somebody intervened. Can you talk about that, or do you know about it?
Yes. Actually, the photograph that is the cover of Subversives is a photograph of Mario Savio being dragged away from the podium at just that incident. It's December 7th, 1964, and Clark Kerr had called a campus-wide meeting at the Greek Theater where he was proposing a way to resolve the free speech movement controversy. And Savio, in suit and tie, waited for Kerr to finish speaking and then got up on the stage, strode to the podium with a scroll in his hand, intending to give his own statement about things. But before he could utter a word, campus police officers grabbed him around the neck and hauled him away. And that's the photograph you're talking about.
Thank you. My name is Otis Paul. I'm commonly at the Cal campus. A quick fact, the Kerr dining room at the faculty club honors Clark Kerr. I don't know of a Reagan dining room or anything. But here's my question. Why is there a Hoover Institute at Stanford?
Well, that's the other Hoover. That's Herbert Hoover.
My apologies.
It's okay. It happens all the time.
I was a student there in 66. I graduated then, and I walked among all of them. But I was wondering about a couple of things I heard about. One was something called COINTELPRO, and the other was the involvement of the U.S. Army in spying on campus, too. Do you have any information on that?
Yeah. Well, COINTELPRO was an FBI operation. It was an acronym for Counterintelligence Program. And the first, there were a series of COINTELPROs, and the first one was started in the 50s and targeted the Communist Party USA. The second one focused on the Socialist Workers Party. Then a third one focused on what were called white extremist groups. There was another one against the New Left, and the last one was on black extremist groups. But COINTELPRO began as a response to the U.S. Supreme Court's imposing restrictions on certain FBI surveillance activities. So Hoover reacted by forming this very secret operation that the Justice Department didn't even know about as a way to, it had the goal of disrupting and neutralizing targeted individuals and groups by interfering with their First Amendment rights. So COINTELPRO, in the records released on the University of California, there are quite a few COINTELPRO documents on the free speech movement, for example. In regards to Army surveillance, the Army and other military agencies were very active in gathering intelligence on campuses during the 60s, and they routinely shared that with the FBI and with local police. And the FBI, in turn, circulated its reports to all these agencies and the CIA. And you can see the copy count on the records showing that.
I'd like to remind our audience again that they're listening to Seth Rosenfeld speaking on his book, Subversives, at the Commonwealth Club of California, and there's time for several more questions.
My question is, there any evidence of any students who are active having their references undermined so that way would be prevented from going on to graduate school? I say this because I was an intern in San Francisco General Hospital in 1963, and we had the first, quote-unquote, event striking for more money. We made $90 a month was our take-home pay. And I always remember there was a headline in the San Francisco Chronicle saying, San Francisco interns revolting. So that's what they thought of us. But what happened was that at least two or three of them had their residencies, UC residencies, yanked because of their agitation. I was just wondering if there was any evidence in that regard.
Yeah. Well, certainly if students subsequently applied for work with the federal government, the agency would routinely check FBI records, and a summary of whatever FBI records existed on them, for example, their involvement in protests, would be sent to that agency. And there is one incident involving Mike Tiger, who was a student at Berkeley, then at Bolt Hall, and went on to become a very famous lawyer. And he had applied for a clerkship with the U.S. Supreme Court Judge Justice Brennan. And after the FBI supplied the court with a resume of his activities as an activist, he was denied that clerkship.
Next question.
In doing your research, you must have come to some conclusions about universities and espionage, the sort of whole phenomena of the university cooperating with the government and undermining either its faculty or leaders, often those who are moderate or idealistic. So my question is, did you come to kind of any general perspective on why this seems to happen at universities and continues to happen today? I think that's pretty obvious. I'm from Canada, and there's student movements there, and professors are being surveilled as well as students even to this day. And you can't get the documents because they're under certain clauses of the Freedom of Information Act that we have in Canada. So I'm just wondering about the whole phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, I think you're correct. It is a phenomena, and it is particular to universities, and there are several reasons for it. One of them is that universities are institutions that depend on having open and spirited debate to arrive at the truth. That's their mission. So they have these debates. They consider all kinds of opinions, including unpopular opinions. So they are inherently vulnerable to surveillance, particularly if this intelligence agency is viewing unpopular opinions as perhaps disloyal. And of course, universities are places where there are many young people who, for the first time, are becoming aware of the greater world and are getting involved in it in various ways. So there's a lot of ferment, which also attracts intelligence agencies. And thirdly, large universities often have foreign students. And the FBI routinely has surveillance of visiting students, foreign students, both out of concern that they might somehow be intelligence plants and also that they might be somehow useful sources.
What about the university's connection to government, government funding?
Yes.
Does that have an impact on this kind of surveillance that happens at universities?
I think it depends on the kind of funding. I mean, certainly if it's funding on military projects or a nuclear arms project, there's a legitimate national security interest there. So the FBI will be paying attention to that. But I would think more general government funding wouldn't provide that rationale.
One last question.
What was the dumbest thing you found?
Well, there are a number of things that didn't seem like they were very wise expenditures of taxpayer dollars. And there are a number of instances in which FBI efforts to stifle dissent backfired. One of them involved the 1960 protest at San Francisco City Hall. The House Un-American Activities Committee was holding a hearing on alleged subversion in the field of education. And a number of students, including from Berkeley, went to see this hearing, only to find that they were denied admittance to the hearing chamber. So they eventually became frustrated. They began to chant. They refused to leave. The San Francisco police arrived and fire hosed them down the marble rotunda. And there's a famous photograph in the San Francisco Chronicle of the water dripping down the steps as the students are being dragged away. Well, Hoover issued a report about that called Communist Target Youth, in which he alleged that the communists had instigated this protest as a way to disrupt the college campuses and to undermine HUAC. But soon after his report came out, and it was very widely circulated, more than 300,000 copies around the country, but soon after that, the students went to trial, and they were all acquitted. So they were not only found innocent, but Hoover's report was upended. And this generated more publicity. The students began to use his report as an example of the government being unfair. And as it turned out, Mario Savio, at that point a high school student in New York City, happened to be in a drugstore one day and picked up an article about this and read about it. And he said, wow, that's really fascinating. Berkeley is the place to be. Yes.
All right. One last question. One is not dumbest, but surprising things was that there was the story you had about how Richard Aoki, this person who was working for the FBI but unbeknownst to everyone, somehow incited the Black Panthers to buy weapons, and that was their first military operation, and it was something that the FBI was doing to balance off with another Black power group. Hmm. Something like that.
Well, I should clarify that. What the record showed actually was that Richard Aoki was a paid FBI informant. At the time, he gave the Black Panthers some of their first guns and firearms training. Aoki had been in the Army Reserve, and he was a gun aficionado. He had a collection of weapons. And soon after the Black Panthers were formed in late 66, they decided to do armed patrols in Oakland, the idea being to focus on what they believed was police abuse. And it was legal to carry a weapon in public at that time. So Bobby Seale writes in his memoir, Seize the Time, that he and Huey Newton went to Aoki and asked him for some weapons and that he provided them. But they had no idea that he was a paid FBI informant at the time. The records that the FBI has released so far on Aoki show without a doubt that he was a paid informant, but the FBI has redacted them so heavily that most of their contents are deleted. And as released, there's no reference indicating that the FBI was involved or even aware of his giving them weapons.
Good to clarify. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Again, I want to thank our radio and online audience as well as our live audience here in San Francisco. And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion.